This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live on TSN1290.ca, good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. 3 hours of hockey talk for you bright and early on this Saturday morning, getting you started with Winnipeg Jets game day coverage of the Jets and the Oilers, 1 p.m. on this fine radio station. Between now and 10 a.m., we'll be joined by Slava Malamud. He's the foreign correspondent for Sport Express. Talk a little bit about that former Winnipeg Jet player. I think you remember his name. It's Alex Burmistrov. Talk about Team Russia for the upcoming Olympics. 9 o'clock this morning, John Forslund, he's the voice of the Carolina Hurricanes, will join us. Talk a little bit more about Coach Paul Maurice. He knows him well from their stint together in Carolina, so you can look forward to that in a couple hours' time. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve, facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. I say good morning before we get into the Winnipeg Jets talk. I say good morning to my colleagues, Richard, Ezra, gentlemen. Good to see you bright and early on this Saturday morning.
Yeah, good to see you guys. Ready to get it going here on this very early, cold Saturday morning.
I actually didn't think it was that cold out.
You didn't think it was nice? Ezzy's under the weather, though.
Oh, Ezzy's got a cold.
Yeah.
Ooh. Mm. Good to know. Ezzy, I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to hug you in the course of the next 3 hours in that case.
That's all right.
Okay.
Just make sure. If you want to, you can, though.
No, I don't. You're sick, obviously. I don't really want to in general.
Oh, good.
You know. So if Ezzy's under the weather, then we'll have to prepare accordingly for that. The Jets and the Oilers, 1 p.m., like I said, off the top today on TSN 1290. Hockey Day in Canada, as they like to bill it. The Jets, good week so far. They can make it a great week, I would suggest. Or probably not even a great week, but an appropriate week when they beat two teams below them in the standings, in the Flames, and if they win today, the Oilers. And on Monday, they defeated a struggling Phoenix Coyotes team. I mean, there was a lot of sort of energy in the building for that, given that it was Paul Maurice's first game as the new Winnipeg Jets head coach. So, you know, today... make it three in a row, and I'd say everybody's hunky-dory heading into a very difficult next week where you face three of the best teams in hockey, the San Jose Sharks, the Anaheim Ducks, the Chicago Blackhawks, and then the Toronto Maple Leafs.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that these two wins are very promising, and the Jets are looking at a very long uphill climb to get into the playoffs, but it's definitely nice to see them get a few wins under their head coach. And as Paul Maurice said yesterday, you don't want to look too much into the goal differential. The Jets have scored 10 goals and only given up 3 goals here. But I think it's very promising that the way that they've played, and you know, with the games that they have coming up. This afternoon's game against the Edmonton Oilers is obviously a must-win, and it's a team that has all types of problems. We talked about it on the midweek show. They just made a goaltending change, and you know, they're basically just starting the moves that they have to make. I wouldn't be surprised if they make 3 or 4 moves before the trade deadline, but it's absolutely promising just the way that the Jets have played with more energy. And it's not that we haven't seen them play this way together, but we haven't seen them play this way in a long time. That 5-game losing streak really was depressing for everyone involved, the players, the fans, and obviously it cost Claude Noel his job, but it's nice to see them playing a more focused, structured game, and you know, hopefully they can continue that and even put together a winning streak and maybe even get back into the playoff race. It's kind of difficult to see them still being in the playoff race with the losing streaks they've had, but you know, with 36 games or so left, you that's what you're playing for. You're still playing for a playoff spot. But absolutely, the way they've played is very impressive, because let's be honest, that 5-game losing streak was probably the sore point of the season. That was probably rock bottom. So it's nice to see that they've responded under their new coach.
Richie, what do you think of the forward lines that Paul Maurice has been employing so far in his two-game tenure as Winnipeg Jets head coach? Ladd, Little, Frolik, Thorburn, Scheifele, and Wheeler. And most people figure Thorburn's there as a bit of a placeholder until Evander Kane comes back. We're not sure when that's going to be. He was placed on IR, but then the Jets also subsequently sent down Carl Klingberg. So, you know, wheels are in motion there. We would expect Kane sometime relatively soon. Setoguchi, Jokinen, and Byfuglien as your, you know, third line, but quantify it however you want. And then Odell, Wright, and Peluso as your fourth line. I think that's clearly the fourth line. So what have you thought about those lines so far?
I mean, the team's played well, Drew. Again, you know, you cautioned it by the fact that they played against a Phoenix team that can't really score. I think it was two goals or less in like seven of their past like 15 games or something like that. And Calgary, who can't score either, who was shut out, I believe, five of seven games over a stretch just recently. But at the same time, and you're playing who you play, and you know, you play the schedule how it is, and you're gonna it's a balanced schedule for the most part here, and the team has played well. I thought that they made a decision to fire Coach Noel at a little bit of a soft spot, and I thought that they chose these this
a soft
timeline.
Spot in the schedule. You mean?
Yeah. Okay. What else would I mean?
I just want to make sure that you know, just making sure.
So they're able to play against Phoenix, and they're able to play against Calgary, and those are two teams that you know they impressively defeat. That's the thing. They didn't just defeat them. Teams that are worse than them, they impressively defeated them. And I have to say that the team is playing, you know, they talk about speed, they talk about all that stuff. They're playing a fast game right now. Now, it's hard to see how much of an effect Paul Maurice has. I mean, certainly there's an energy level, and certainly there's all that stuff. But it's hard to see how much of an effect he's had when they don't play against anybody quality. Like, I mean, I'm looking at the Calgary roster, and the team, the Jets dominated that game. Like, that's as well as they've played. But look at this Calgary roster, and I see, you know, Ladislav Smead, Giordano, Weidman, Brody. Those are all defensemen, National Hockey League defensemen. Now, whether there's number one in there, you can certainly get an argument. But these are the forwards that we're looking at in that game. Colborne, Backlund, Westgarth, McGrattan, Boma, Stajan, Stempniak, Monahan, Hudler, Byron, Street, Gagliardi. I mean, guys, there's one top six guy in there, Hudler. Monahan, I wouldn't even say is a top six yet. He eventually will be that. And then the rest of those guys are third line guys and fourth and AHLers. And so it's a lot easier as you to dominate the puck when the other team just clearly not as talented as you are. Now, the Jets are playing. The Jets have talent. I think that's one thing that on this show, you know, we don't think they're, at least we don't think, collectively, I don't think we think that they're, you know, certainly not in the class of Chicago, St. Louis. I mean, that goes without saying. But I thought coming into the season, we thought they'd be battling with the likes of Colorado and the Minnesota, and whether those teams were a little bit better than them or not was the question. But for there to be this big of a gap probably wasn't expected. So I expect them probably to bridge that gap. But there will be some bumps in the road here. And Paul Maurice, as a coach, that's when you'll see if the team's responding to him, when they face a little bit of adversity. Right now, things are going well, so everybody's feeling great.
And a big criticism of the Jets this year has been that they have played teams that are clearly below them as far as talent-wise in the roster goes. And Calgary Flames are one of those. The Calgary Flames defeated the Jets in Winnipeg, and that was one mm-hmm. of those games where mm-hmm. they really should have had. But you know, when Mike Camilleri's not in the lineup, they don't have the that's depth right. to really deal with that. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, this is a game that they should have dominated. They did dominate. They've dominated two games in a row, and again, it's a nice beginning to Paul Maurice's tenure. And they have the Oilers coming up, all sorts of problems, and it's another team that they're not going to have Neil Yakupov, and they're, mm-hmm. they don't have Alishamsky, so it's another team. Again, Brizgalov hasn't really found his game from a couple of years ago in Philadelphia, so it's another team that you should beat. And, you know, Drew mentioned that Anaheim and San Jose are coming up. Those are two teams that don't lose very much. When you talk about the Ducks just lost for the first time in nine games, so are the games you have to win.
They haven't lost on home ice yet this year. I mean, which is just, they're 22 games into the season, and they have not lost in regulation on home ice, which is just an incredible stat. And those are going to be the real big tests. I think that's what this is a nice sort of, warm-up for Coach Paul Maurice. And general managers, I think, in my time, they sort of look for these, like you said, these soft spots on the schedule to put a new coach in. Hey, get some momentum, you know, get some wins under his belt. Everybody's buying in.
Nobody's putting a new coach in coming up against Chicago Blackhawks. You just can't, because the players buy, I've said this so many times now, the players buy in when you're winning, and especially early on. They're listening to a new message, and if you're winning, it works, and then they buy in. Mm-hmm. If you're losing, they may not buy in, so
Well, you know, what I liked about that Thursday game against Calgary is it was 4-0 for the Jets after 40 minutes. Yeah. And then Calgary comes in and they get that early goal in the third period. Mm-hmm. And it's 4-1. And then Olli Jokinen takes that penalty. Mm-hmm. And then Paul Maurice immediately uses his timeout. And I think he knows, I mean, he seems to know or have a good feel for this roster.
Hold on, was that before or after that beautiful save by Pavlik? Before.
I think it was before the beautiful save.
That's where the credit to me goes.
Right.
It goes to Pavlik, not to Maurice, because that save, if you don't make that save 4-2, I still think the Jets win, but the point is that game is different. So everybody likes to criticize Pavlik.
Yeah.
And I know he's playing against a poor team there. And yeah, you can get back to your point about Maurice Drew, but Pavlik's played a nice solid couple games here.
Yeah, he's...
Sure looks a lot better when teams are playing defense in front of him.
He wasn't tremendously... I mean, he didn't face a ton of shots on Thursday, but Calgary had some decent scoring opportunities, I thought, and he was up to the challenge.
That leg save was certainly changed the tenor of the game.
Sure, otherwise it's 4-2 with, 18 minutes to go?
Left, yeah.
And I mean, I think it's safe to say the Jets' confidence, when they have confidence, is fragile at best.
Yep.
So, all of a sudden it's 4-2 and maybe they fall back into some of those bad habits that they had beforehand. But I like the combination of Maurice calling the timeout, settling his team down. It's like taking a timeout in basketball. You either have to take it sort of right before a team stop the team's momentum from getting on that big, long, 20-2 roll. So he calls that timeout and he tries to settle them down. And then he asks his goaltender to make a big save, which he does. And then Michael Frolik, has good play against the boards and draws a penalty. And then Jacob Trouba walks in and makes a 5-1 and it's a beautiful goal. Yeah, and a beautiful goal, and it's all over at that point in time, except for the fights in the crowd.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, so, there are some, I know he's a new coach to this team, mm-hmm. but I think he's sort of got an idea of what he's got here for a team in terms of, I think he's seen this team before. Somewhere in the course of his tenure as a head coach, I think he's seen a young team with confidence, not with confidence, but with some talent that doesn't necessarily know how to always put away an opponent.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't disagree with that, Drew. I think that when Maurice is covering the National Hockey League for TSN, he gets able to cover the league on a different macro level that most other coaches aren't able to. So he should have an idea of what coaches. And I believe that he had his eye on this job and some other jobs probably. When you're analyzing Ezzy and you're Paul Maurice, you're not looking at the Chicago job going, that'd be a nice job to have. You're not getting that job. Okay, but you're looking at Winnipeg. Okay, there's a possibility there. You're looking at Edmonton. Well, but that kind of idea. There's a possibility there. You're looking at Calgary. Okay, there's a possibility there. I got to keep my eye on these teams. So I'm not surprised that he kept a close eye on some teams like this as opposed to some other ones.
It's just almost prudent behavior because he gets to come in. And, he's not completely cold to the situation there. He's like, yeah, I've been watching them. I know what I can see on TV. Now I want to see it in person. And then I want to implement whatever changes I'm going to make at that point in time. So he's not a neophyte to the team, even though he's only been around the team for, I guess, really 5 days at this point in time.
The truth is, there is no pressure on him right now. The season, for all intents and purposes, is done playoff-wise. Now, I don't think they can make a little bit of a run here to make it interesting.
Yeah.
But the point is, the pressure, the expectations are that they won't make it. So when your expectations are that you won't make it, you have less pressure on your shoulders. And I honestly think that your own personal pressure for like a Jokinen or Setoguchi to get a contract is different than team pressure. It's just different. And I think this team is playing right now with a little bit of confidence, and I think with a little bit of a weight off their shoulders, both coaching-wise and playoff pressure-wise. It's a hell of a lot easier to play when you don't think you're going to make the playoffs.
It's like when you're 20 games below 500 in baseball, and all of a sudden, well, look at how we did great. We did great the last 6 weeks of the season, and we ended up 2 games over 500.
Similar idea in that respect. Now, we're still mid-season, but the point is that when you're that far out and the fans aren't saying, all the fans want to see, I think, is a good, honest effort. And the fact is that their effort wasn't there. Zach Bogosian said as much. Our effort wasn't good enough. And that's never a good thing. And you feel bad for the coach. And as he talked about that on Wednesday, feeling bad for Noel in that respect. But at the same time, if the fans are just going to be happy with the effort and they've got a little bit of change and you've appeased them to some extent, then just go out and play. And it's a lot easier to go out and play.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to deal with, we're going to talk about TSN's reorientation series, which aired on TSN SportsCenter throughout the course of this week, and we'll discuss the concept and the general idea of homophobia in hockey. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Minutes past 7 in the morning on this Saturday morning, McPhillips Toyota Winnipeg Jets game day here on TSN 1290. Online, tsn1290.ca. Gentlemen, a very important series undertaken by, I think it was led by Aaron Ward of TSN. He was the sort of the moderator behind the series. It aired on SportsCenter throughout the course of this week. It was called Reorientation, and it dealt with sort of homophobia in the locker rooms of NHL teams and homophobia in hockey. And, you know, I'll give the NHL credit. We like to rag on the NHL because they do a lot of things that sort of scratch their heads. But to me, they really have been at the forefront of the movement to combat homophobia in sports. And I would suggest that trickles down to all walks of life. So they do get full credit for that. You know, their promotion and their involvement with the You Can Play program certainly has been well documented. You know, how bad... You know, you guys have been, you know, how bad do you think homophobia is in hockey right now?
Before we start, and that was a good introduction, Drew, I just want to say, if you haven't seen the series, because I believe it aired Wednesday through Friday, but you can actually go on tsn.ca and you can watch the entire series, the reorientation series. It's a three-part series. They're about 8 to 9 minutes each, I believe. I watched them last night because I didn't have a chance to watch them live. But I recommend, if you haven't, if you're listening or you're listening to the podcast, I definitely recommend watching this because it's extremely well done. It's you got to watch it, not just if you're a hockey fan, especially if you're a hockey fan, Richie, but if you're a sports fan, because it's very well done. The interviews in this are excellent. Aaron Ward did a very good job. And for Aaron Ward to do this, it's really impressive. And, you know, back to your question, you know, Drew, on the topic of homophobia in sports and in hockey, I think we've come a long way, but I don't think we're anywhere close to where we need to be. And that's not to say that the NHL hasn't done a very good job. It's just that I think we're getting there slowly because it's a subject that people wouldn't even talk about before. And now you have a situation where Patrick Burke, we've given him a lot of credit on the show, and we'll give it to him again. He deserves a lot of credit because he's really been the face, and he said this. He wants to eliminate homophobia in hockey and in all of sports, and he deserves a lot of credit for what he's doing through the videos he's done and all of the speaking engagements. And, you know, Ben Scrivens is interviewed in there, and he goes to the Pride Parade, you know, and it's just a really well done documentary. But as far as homophobia goes in hockey specifically, just to answer your original question, Drew, I think it's hard to maybe quantify exactly how bad it is as far as the, I guess, the perceptions of hockey players in general. You know, I guess the best way that you can really hear about it or know how bad it is by listening to some of the interviews, Andrew Ferentz or Dustin Brown. I think it's getting better, but I still think that, for example, Patrick Burke in the series says that we believe there is a gay player in the NHL. He just hasn't come out yet. So if it was at the level that it needed to be, that player would come out, right? So I think that we've come a long way over the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years. And I think we have a long way to go as far as changing the entire culture and saying that it's okay, you know, to come out of the closet if you haven't already. So I think it's come a long way to go.
Richie, what impact does it have on, say, you know, minor hockey players when they, if they see their heroes, the professional hockey players, standing up and saying, no, that language is inappropriate, you can't say that. If anybody on your team, doesn't matter about their sexual orientation, does that have a significant impact, I think, on the minor leagues of hockey?
Yeah, like it does, Drew. I don't buy that to as much of an extent as I think some other people do, in the sense that I think parents have the primary responsibility and role of affecting whether or not their children treat the other people the way they ought to be treated, at least in my opinion. So you know, we read a lot about problems and issues, whether it be fighting or whether it be, you know, and this issue in terms of, you know, homophobia. You know, it might have an effect if Aaron Ward does a special on TSN. It may have an effect on one or two players or more than that, and that's great. But it's at home. That's where it matters most. And that's who has the biggest effect on these kids. So, and there's only so far you can get in terms of that analysis. So I think it's a great cause, and I think it does. They're making a great push, and eventually somebody will come out. And I mean, I think it's an issue for sure. I don't think it's as big of an issue as it has been, and I think with time it'll, you know, it will be less of an issue. I think a lot of times the people's the wording and different things that people say isn't necessarily in line with what they believe, you know, the slang and other terms like that. Doesn't mean it's any easier to accept, but I don't think there's a malicious intent on often occasions. It doesn't mean that I don't think there are homophobic hockey players, but I'm not so sure it's as bad as people think. That's just my opinion. Maybe I'm naive to the fact, but again, the raising the awareness is never a bad thing.
Let's say hypothetically, or you know, or not hypothetically, but any minor hockey league coach, you know, he's coaching, you know, Midget or Adam or whatever, and he hears homophobic language in the dressing room. Do you think that head coach, that assistant coach, whomever that authority figure has a responsibility to cut it out of his team's dressing room?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and you just tell the kids that that's not acceptable, but you're with the kids for an hour, and that certainly can have an effect. But then they go home with their parents and with their friends, and maybe they do listen to you for the rest of time, or probably not. See what I mean? Like, that's the point. Yeah. So you have an effect. We've been in these dressing rooms, both playing and coaching. You have an effect, but also, I mean, I think that's limited to an extent.
Right, and, you know, I think Richie's trying to say that it's not just the coaches, it's not just the players in the dressing room, but is the parents do have a huge role, just like parents have a huge role in the education of their kids in addition to the education they receive in elementary school through high school and university. Mm-hmm. So I think it is really, when they say examining the changing culture of homophobia, a culture, there's a lot of different tentacles to culture, right? And I think that when it comes to homophobia, again, I thought it was really interesting that Aaron Ward said that they asked many players for interviews and they refused. And he kind of, I actually really liked that he put that in there, because he was saying that, you know, I think homophobia is really less of a problem than it used to be, and it's getting a lot better. But not a lot of players will come in front of a camera and say that. They'll you know, put their name to a PSA, but they don't want to be on TSN and all that. So that just shows you that not as many players as you think are comfortable about it. And really, every player should be comfortable about it, or not every player, because I think there's always going to be people, because of their beliefs, don't believe in a certain way. But I think for the most part, you'd think that the majority of players are comfortable with it. They'll talk about it. Because as I said, and Aaron Ward mentions this in this series, that really it's not where it needs to be. Because if it was where it needs to be, and we don't know with certainty that there is a homosexual player in the NHL, but they say that they believe, Patrick Burke, this isn't me saying this, believes that...
He's going on the odds too, right?
He's going on the odds and saying, okay, there's 750 players or so, there's a chance that one of them is homosexual, so, and they haven't come out. So the point being that we still don't know for sure, and it's at a point where we really need to keep educating and basically changing that culture. And changing that culture, as Richie said, starts at home, continues with the coaches, and then ultimately comes down to the players on the ice.
Given that the NHL has been a driving force behind anti-homophobia in sports, do they have an obligation to do something or say something with regard to the upcoming Sochi Olympics and Russia's anti-gay laws?
The players?
The players and the hockey world in general. I mean, I can't, you know, obviously not every player holds the same beliefs. But, you know, do you think that the NHL, you know, can the NHL be supportive with their left hand of anti-homophobia and at the right hand sort of close their eyes to what's happening in Russia? While at the same time supporting it with the Olympic participation?
You know, Drew, first off, the players want to go to the Olympics more than the NHL does.
Right.
Okay, let's be clear there. The NHL doesn't want to go to the Olympics.
No, of course not.
There's a ton of money.
There's no money for them, and it takes away 2 weeks of their season.
That's exactly right. And it compacts the schedule.
And that's why they only really signed the agreement, what, 3 or 4 months before the Olympics started?
It was negotiated in the CBA, behind the scenes.
It's the players. Do they have a right to do it? Well, I think, if they speak out about it, if they raise the awareness, sure. I mean, because you participate in the Olympics in Russia doesn't mean you support their beliefs there and their laws there. I mean, I think it's the opposite. When you go there and it's an issue, you raise awareness and people talk about it, and hopefully it opens up some eyes. So I don't think it's necessarily sucking and blowing. I get the point, but I don't necessarily think it's sucking and blowing in that instance.
I think it's just refreshing to see a series like this because, really the way it was done, there was a player who, I wasn't sure if his name was pronounced Ezra or Esra Tualu. But there's an interview. He's a football player. He played in the NFL for 9 years, if you've seen the series. And his comments, I mean, he said he wanted to take his own life. I mean, hearing guys talk about that, I think really does have a big impact.
He came out as gay afterwards, correct?
Afterwards.
After his NFL career.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then you have Robbie Rogers, who plays for the, I believe it's Los Angeles and the MLS. And you have these players talking about it. And I really think it... To me, I've seen other pieces on homophobia and read other pieces on homophobia, and I really think this one will stick in the minds of young hockey players, adult hockey players, and I really commend them for, I think Aaron Ward did a really good job on this series.
I hope Ward doesn't mind when I do my own special called Redraft, when it's the Jets draft Peter Forsberg and not Aaron Ward.
Check out the series. It's available on the TSN website, tsn.ca. When we come back, we're going to focus our attention on the Eastern Conference standings. 6 points separate 5th place and 13th place. We'll break it down for you. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Seven:30 in the morning. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. TSN 1290. .ca. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com. You still have 5.5 hours to submit your guess for the Illegal Curve game-winning goal contest and the Illegal Curve 50-50 contest. Use hashtag ICGWG and hashtag IC5050. Win great Illegal Curve merchandise. For more information, you can check out the website, IllegalCurve.com. Gentlemen, the Eastern Conference playoff race. I know it's only game 48, game 50, whatever it actually is. The Eastern Conference playoff race is really close. We've heard all year about how lousy the Eastern Conference is, and that's generally speaking still seems to be the case. But there's only six points that separate 5th place from 13th place in the Eastern Conference, and there's only 2 points that separate the 5th overall from 10th overall in the Eastern Conference.
Easy for you to say, Drew.
I know, no kidding. You look at the Eastern Conference, and there sort of seems to be a clear divide. The top four, Pittsburgh, Boston, Tampa, and Montreal. Those seem to be, those teams, barring a real big meltdown, seem to be pretty solidly in place as playoff teams. Tampa Bay, most people would be surprised about, but they've managed to, maintain their position despite losing Steven Stamkos for most of the year so far. And so when he's back, and we expect that he's going to be back within the next month at the very least, that we expect the Lightning would continue to play well. Then you look at the bottom four playoff spots right now. The Philadelphia Flyers, 53 points. The New York Rangers, 53 points. The Toronto Maple Leafs, 53 points. And the Washington Capitals, 52 points.
Like Jimmy Fallon or Jimmy Kimmel? Or his monologue's longer?
Fair enough.
Keep going, Drew.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. After the Caps, you have the Senators with 51 points, the Devils with 51 points, the Red Wings with 50 points, the Blue Jackets with 48, and the Hurricanes with 47. That seems to be where, after that, everybody falls off the possibilities of being playoff teams. Who do you like out of the East the most of those bottom, say, 7 or 8 teams as making the playoffs and potentially making a run?
Well, that was so long. I think I like the Hartford Whalers to make the playoffs this year. I think they have a great chance. I mean, Drew, if you look at the bottom four teams, and Izzy did a nice job putting together kind of this package and that we're going over here, Philly, Rangers, and Toronto, Washington, I mean, first off, all these teams are significantly flawed, right? I mean, you're looking at some pretty poor teams, I think, in, you know, the Flyers, they've certainly turned it around. It's just, there's a lack of speed there. I think Rangers overall forwards, and they can't really find that mix in terms of who to rely on defensively, with Elaine Vigneault being very finicky with Delzotto and such. Lundqvist has played certainly better. Toronto's all over the map, and Washington's, I think, a flawed team as well. So one team I keep my eye on here is Columbus. And, you know, they came in last week, and they're a team that's playing without Gabrick, and they might get rid of Gabrick for all I know, but they're playing really well as a team. And when you get solid goaltending and play well as a team, they could, to me, surprise some people here.
Yeah, I did a little schedule analysis here, and I know, you know, Richie likes the Jackets there. I don't think the Jackets are going to quite have enough to get into the playoffs here. They have only a few points, really, to get over the line here. But if you look at, it's kind of interesting if you look at the schedules here of the bottom four teams and the four teams that are just outside of the playoffs. And to nobody's surprise, the team I like actually is the Devils. And if you look at their schedule, they've got, of their 33 games remaining, they've got 20 at home.
Yeah.
And 10 of their last 14 are at home. And they've got some easy games coming up, a lot against the Islanders and the Panthers. But if you look at the teams, you know, I was kind of going through these teams and I was kind of thinking, how are Ottawa and Detroit both not going to get into the playoffs here? And it was tough for me. I think Detroit is going to be close, but ultimately I have Washington coming down. I still have Toronto making the playoffs. Even though it pains me to say that, I still think Toronto is going to make the playoffs, even though they do have 19 of the remaining 33 games on the road. And they haven't been a very good road team this year.
Do you think it's possible, looking at this list, do you think it's possible all four of those teams will make the playoffs that are in there right now? I mean, it's not, I don't think it's going to happen, but it's conceivable, right?
I actually have the Rangers moving up in the standings and finishing fourth. I think Tampa Bay is going to come down a little bit. But no, I don't. I actually, the only team there that I think that is going to come down, and again, you could look at these teams right now, and you could easily put Detroit, Columbus, and New Jersey in the playoffs. I personally don't, looking at the schedule. If you look at the Detroit Red Wings schedule, it's pretty much even. You've got 18 games remaining at home, 17 on the road. The Red Wings have only won 6 games at home, so really, if that doesn't turn around quickly,
that's
going to be hard. Also, Detroit was one of those teams, Richie, it's funny you mentioned that. Look at the month of March. They have one of the busiest schedules, 15 games in March, 8 at home, and you've got the Penguins, Wild, Canadiens, Lightning.
And by on that point, Detroit's going to have a lot of guys in the Olympics and coach in the Olympics, so that's going to be a tough March to come back from after traveling over there.
Yep. No, that's a good point. That's something that I think kind of gets missed sometimes in kind of this season, because it's a different season. You're going to have that long, nearly 3-week break in between. So, again, you look at these teams, and it's really unbelievable. And you could even throw in, the only reason why I didn't throw in the Islanders into this is because Carolina has 3 games in hand on the Islanders.
Right. Islanders are 8-2 in their last 10, for the record.
Yep.
Yeah, so the Islanders are only 7 points out of a playoff spot right now. So right now it's ultra tight. And, you know, just going over the remaining schedule here, I think you have a fascinating playoff race here. And Washington, to me, the reason why I think Washington does eventually fall out is because, and again, in the schedule, the amount of games against non-playoff teams, it's fairly even. The Rangers, I mentioned, I think are going to go up. That's because they have a lot of remaining games against non-playoff teams. That's current non-playoff teams. But for the most part, the bottom seeds have about 14 or 15 games remaining against non-playoff teams. And then you have the Red Wings. And again, that goes back to what I said there. 11 games remaining against current non-playoff teams. So you've got the Red Wings guys have really had that horrible home record, and they haven't been able to turn it around. And I keep saying, how do the Detroit Red Wings, a team that always makes the playoffs, how are they not going to be in the playoffs? But if you look at it, they've really put themselves, you know, behind it here, especially with their record at home, and they really don't, it's not going to get easier for them.
That's some bad injuries. Now, Philly is a team that's interesting to me in that I think they're going to make the playoffs because if you just look at their schedule, as you did a good job here, 20 games at home, 14 on the road, 10 against current non-playoff teams, and I know they play the Bruins and the Penguins 6 times, so that's a lot. But Philly has a bunch of players who are really good but not going to the Olympics. Wayne Simmons. You know, I know Hartnell's got that injury, but Hartnell, Giroux, LeCavalier, Shen. Like, all those guys are good, but all those guys are going to get 2.5, 3 weeks off. Right? And some of those guys could use it. A little bit older team could use it, right? Mm-hmm. You got Coburn, guys like that. They're good. They're good players, but they're not Olympians. So aside from like your Jakub Voracek, you're limited in terms of your core guys who are going over there and are going to take a pounding. And so they should be rested going down to the stretch. I think they're going to make it. But see, to me, like the Rangers, Leafs, and Washington, I know the Rangers are figuring out a little bit here, but the Leafs and Washington are just such flawed teams defensively.
Yeah.
Right? Now, that shows you how weak the Eastern Conference is, because these other teams in here, I mean, every team has its flaws, right? You talk about Ottawa. They just an inconsistent bunch for times of, you know, what are they? Do they need another top six guy? Do they need help on defense, puck moving defense? And they have holes, right? The Devils.
They've given up the second most goals in the Eastern Conference this year.
Right. And a part of that is, you know, people say, okay, defensively. Yeah, but part of that's also getting the puck out of your own zone, mm-hmm. right? And you look at the Devils. Well, the Devils on paper are nothing to write home about. This is why, and I've said it before, this is why I like Peter DeBoer as a coach. I think he's one of the more underrated coaches in the National Hockey League. I know they have two netminders, Brodeur's than what he once was, but he's still given a good workmanlike effort. Schneider's, you know, a good young goalie. And they signed some of these veteran guys. But the Devils, as he is put together here, 18 games against non-playoff teams, 20 at home and 13 on the road. That's a pretty appealing schedule. Right? And then, you know, Detroit is probably the most talented of the bunch. Columbus works hard. Carolina, I don't think, makes it. So these teams, the Eastern Conference is so flawed, you know, one or two injuries or one or two streaks, and it puts the whole playoffs on its face.
That's why I think it's so, you know, interesting to bring this up. You're 47 to 50 games into the season here, and you look at the schedule, it's just, I think it's interesting. I could be completely wrong about this, and Detroit could get in there. And Richie mentioned he might see Columbus taking that last spot from either the Caps or the Leafs. But really, if you look at the schedule, sure, some teams have certain advantages, but really, there's no reason to believe that it's not going to come down to the last week or definitely 2-3 weeks of the season here, because all of these teams really have gone up and down. Toronto, you saw they were leading the division, and they've really come back down to life. I really don't like the Leafs schedule. A lot of games on the road, and they play a lot of good teams, a lot of Western teams. They have their fair share of games against non-playoff teams, but mm-hmm. There's nobody that's really taking over this bottom part of the conference. Pittsburgh, Boston, Tampa, Montreal, I think we didn't put them in here because there's really that separation. There's 6 points there. Yeah. But really, it's almost more than that because Montreal has struggled at times, and Tampa Bay, Boston, Pittsburgh, they've been up there the whole year. But I think it's going to be an unbelievable Eastern Conference playoff race. And the Flyers and the Rangers, we talked about this earlier on in the season. I think we all thought that they were going to stick around in the playoff race. But it's really unbelievable that you have Ottawa, Detroit, two teams that I think all of us picked to be in the playoffs.
Yeah, but
it's going to be tough for them because, you know, you only have to make one or two points here, but their schedules just aren't very favorable. It's unbelievable. I think one of the biggest surprises to me of the season, Tampa Bay being in third place in the East at this point is one of them, but to me, Detroit's record at home is, I'm really flabbergasted the way they've played, and everybody saw the 24/7 series. It's amazing because Detroit is a team, they are the model of consistency, right? And it's not like this team isn't a good team. Sure, over the years they've lost players, but, you know, you bring in Steven Weiss and that hasn't worked out. And, you know, the goaltending, there have been issues there with Howard's injury and he's struggled. But it's really unbelievable. If you look at Detroit, only has 6 wins, 47 games into the season. It's unbelievable. At home, I should say. But it's going to be a very interesting playoff race, and you might see one or two teams drop out. As Richie said, he wouldn't be surprised if 3 or 4 teams in that bottom four drop out.
And Detroit's an example. If you look at Detroit's record versus Toronto's record with respect to the shootout.
Yeah.
That's the thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Toronto's just is winning in the shootout. Look at Detroit's record at home. 7 shootout losses.
you put those as wins, and all of a sudden,
but half of them is for, you know.
Yeah.
And then you're in your 53 points, right? As and yep. then you're cracking a spot. I mean, that's the thing. 53 points in your fifth spot right now.
I hate to say it, but it is going to come down to that. Those extra little shootout, like the Devils have 11 points from shootouts.
There's a good article on Grantland. Down Goes Brown with a good article about the loser point, the overtime and the shootout point. So you can check that out if you want.
ESPN covers hockey.
ESPN Grantland sort of covers hockey. But yeah, not very much. Can't get a highlight if your life depended on it, though. Don't worry about that. That hasn't changed. Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll go around the league, do some NHL news and notes. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Ten minutes before the top of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, online at tsn1290.ca.
Well, this is the best day ever. This is the best day ever. Jets, Oilers, it's going to be a great game.
Yeah.
But our good friends, Jeff and Marshall Stevenson, have brought us McDonald's and Tim Hortons, basically enough to feed an army here. Our good buddies...
Or a one-man army, as he likes to call himself sometimes.
Jeff and Marshall.
You had a bite there. I mean, sorry, Drew, you had a couple bites there. Don't worry.
You know, you always take the high road, Richard, and pretend that you're not as bad as the rest of us. But lo and behold, was it after?
Drew, I had one bite. You had about six in that break.
I'll tell you what. Last Saturday night after, you know, you guys went out, it was your brother's birthday, it was Remus' birthday,
yeah.
You know, you threw down the greasy late night food as much as anybody else did.
Oh, I did, I know, just not between breaks, like as quickly as you did, Drew.
Okay, as long as
Drew, if you want to get into a Hot Dog Chronicles here, we can get into a Hot Dog
Chronicles. We don't need to get into any Hot Dog Chronicles, but let's go into NHL News and Notes.
NHL News and Notes.
Ottawa Senators on Thursday night, or actually I guess Friday morning, they objected to it, and that was PK Subban's celebration after scoring the overtime winning goal to beat them on Thursday in Ottawa. I should point out that was practically a home game for the Montreal Canadiens. There were so many Habs fans in attendance. Did you have a problem with PK Subban's antics after that game winning goal on Thursday?
Well, I know you're talking to me because Ezzy's got a mouthful of McMuffin right now.
Again, thanks to Marshall and Jeff for bringing this McDonald's in, because this is incredible.
Do I have an issue with it? If I'm the Ottawa Senators, I have an issue with it. Yeah, I mean, calm down, Subban. It's the middle of the regular season. You scored a goal in overtime that just trickled through the net manager's pads, and you celebrated like you won the Stanley Cup. I mean, this is the thing. Montreal players should have a problem with it because it just motivates your opponent. And your opponent, by the way, that, if I recall correctly, handled you pretty well in the playoffs last year.
Yeah.
So, I just don't understand. Well, he just doesn't care. And I know it's passion, all that stuff, but you need to kind of curb that a little bit. I know, let him do what he wants, but he doesn't care, fine. He may not care, but if you're going to be playing this team, and now with this division format, I know there's a wild card, but this division format, if you're going to be going through this team in the playoffs, why would you want to provide extra motivation? And it's like the whole Bill Belichick thing. You see this whole week when, you know, against the Broncos. He's not giving anything. Why do you give extra things for your opponent to be motivated about?
Off topic, but Bill Belichick telling his players not to get high in Denver was amazing.
I didn't see that.
You didn't see that? He cautioned his players, you're not allowed to smoke weed even though it's legal in Denver. I thought that was genius. Ezzy, do you have a problem with Subban's antics?
Yeah, when are we going to Denver? When are we doing an Illegal Curve road trip to Denver? I tell you, this fast food would come in handy later on at night.
Well, focus on the question.
I don't have any problem with it. I know Richie's saying that, you know, you're giving the opponent extra motivation. This is what PK Subban does. And you know what? I really like PK Subban as a player. And I think that if he wants to celebrate,
so do I.
He'll deal with the repercussions. So to me, I don't understand why this is such a big deal.
Teammates have to deal with repercussions if they're more motivated to play against them. It just doesn't make any sense. Like,
it's good. He has a swagger to him. Bring the swag back, Richie.
Even the players on his team are chasing him around, thinking like, "Why is he doing this?" I don't know. I don't like it. I wouldn't even like it if he was on my team. That's what I'm saying too. I wouldn't like it.
I understand your point, Richie, about it giving motivation and everything else, and that's a good enough reason for him not to do it.
Why would you provide Ottawa with motivation?
I mean, you're
fighting for your playoff life. These games are important. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I get that point. I mean, I don't mind the celebration. I don't mind the exuberance.
Drew, you're an exuberant guy.
Thank you. I sort of buy into the argument that you don't want the guy to celebrate. Don't let him score, which is what Subban sort of said afterwards. But I do get your point of doing is giving your opponent fuel.
I don't know. I don't like it. That argument, I can understand in some senses, but you always use that in college football when they're up 45-0 and they score. You know, you don't want them to score.
That's
clearly they can't stop you.
No.
Now, in this case, it's not necessarily, you know, the same argument. But
it was like Yakupov's celebration. I think it was Yakupov when he scored that game-winning goal.
It's ridiculous.
Who's that against? Los Angeles?
Yeah, LA. It's ridiculous.
Yes.
Not that they're so irrelevant, the Oilers. That doesn't really matter because LA doesn't care about them. But, like, this is a playoff race. LA is like, oh, the Oilers are here. 2 points.
Right.
That night, but every other time.
Whereas the Habs and the Sens are gonna meet each other in the playoffs potentially, or there's a possibility that they could meet each other like they did last year.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's playoff ramifications there.
Moving to Colorado, Ryan O'Reilly, very interesting case here. He of course was sort of holding out or was unsigned out of the lockout, and Calgary signed him to that offer sheet, which Colorado eventually matched. It's now going to cost Colorado $6.5 million in a qualifying offer this off season if they want to retain his rights. What do you think Colorado does with Ryan O'Reilly, and is he worth $6.5 million?
No, he's not worth $6.5 million. But the qualifying offer allows you to retain his rights, and the question is it $2 million more than he's worth, as opposed to losing him completely to free agency? Is that an issue? Now, I have to look at the CBA. I haven't looked at it, but if they qualify him at 6.5, I don't believe the arbitration award can be less than that.
I think so.
So
he could sign a long
There's no 10% kicker. I think it's at 6.5. There's no issue there, but I don't think they can get him any less than that. You have to qualify him, Drew, because for the $2 million, you know, don't sign that 6th and 7th defenseman for more money. Bring up the young guys and keep one of your guys who's one of Patrick Waugh's boys, plays center, plays wing, can play in every situation, power play, penalty kill, even strength. You can't let him go.
Yeah, Richie, I did read the CBA. I read it in its entirety and memorized the whole thing. So, no, I'm just kidding. But, you know,
is that the collective burger agreement?
as far as Ryan O'Reilly goes, if you're going to qualify him, and then your intention is to sign him, I think he's going to be wanting a longer-term deal. I'm
sure, fascinated. But maybe less money. Fine.
And I'm fascinated to see what they do with Ryan O'Reilly, because we all know with what the Flames did with Jay Feaster and that offer sheet, and I think they would have possibly lost him because of a clause in the CBA. And if you look at kind of the team going forward, if you take Ryan O'Reilly off that roster, I really like Ryan O'Reilly as a player, and I think he's underrated, especially because he's not an 80-point guy. He's a guy that will go in the corners, go in the dirty areas, really good shot. As Richie mentioned, he's versatile. He's not necessarily excellent at any one thing, but very good at different facets of the game. He's one of those players that I think a lot of teams would want. I would have to think that because the Colorado Avalanche went through that whole process and matched the offer from the Calgary Flames, they're going to be looking to sign him. Joe Sakic will be looking to sign him. I guess Patrick Waugh too, right? But it's going to be interesting to see there, because are they going to offer him a bridge contract? Because he's still only, 22, 23 years old?
Yeah, he's really young.
I think people think he's older, 23.
So, I mean, when you look at it from that perspective, I agree. Plus, it's that kind of a guy. Look at the Edmonton wanting a guy like that. You know, a guy who can be a kind of a jack of all trades, whereas, you know, if they only have skill, he's 22 years old, excuse me. He's turning 23 in a month. So, you know, how do you get – it's all about the replacement. The replacement cost. What are you trading to get a guy to replace O'Reilly to save $2 million? In theory, on principle.
Sure.
So
you just bite the bullet.
You bite the bullet, and you know, Feaster screwed you over with, and the league over with inflation and all that stuff, but he doesn't care. Brian Burke might give an offer sheet.
You know, you mentioned the Oilers, who are obviously here this afternoon. You know, you mentioned that Ryan O'Reilly probably isn't worth $6.5 million, Richie, but I bet you'd agree that a team is going to pay probably more than his market value because these type of players just don't come up. If you look at the UFA market, and obviously we're going to talk about it more and more into the spring and leading up into the summer, but there's a lot of good players on this UFA market, but there are a lot of veteran players.
Right.
And there aren't a lot of guys that are in their prime right now and that can do the types of things that Ryan O'Reilly can do. So I know they were talking about it on TSN on insider trading, and it's going to be a really interesting thing to see what they do with O'Reilly. I would think that they're going to try to sign him to 5 years.
If it's a 23-year-old UFA who's played 5 years and could do everything, you're going to break the bank.
Yeah.
So
yeah, well, that's just
at the end of the day, you qualify him, you pay him a little bit more, and it's a $5 million cap hit, but of course the structure of the deal makes the qualifying offer so much higher. So, I mean... Was it not enough to get him a 2-year, $10 million deal with a qualifying offer of 5 and 5? Like, was that the kicker for Jay Feaster? Like, for the agent, excuse me? Like, great job by the agent, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, because we've seen agents mismanage, like for Cody Franzen, in my opinion. But he said, I'll give you an offer sheet of 2 years, $10 million. I'll sign you to that. And the agent's like, no. We don't only want 2 years, $10 million. We want 2 years, $10 million, and the 6.5 kicker. So like, what was Jay Feaster thinking? Because even if they did sign him, so they were giving up the pick, although it was all screwed up with that, the way they did it.
The waiver situation, because he played over in the KHL.
Right, if it gone smoothly, you're giving up the pick, and then you have to qualify him yourself at 6.5. I realized it was to try and make Colorado not match, but was a 5, is a 2 years, 10 not enough? I don't know.
It was a, you can see why Colorado wouldn't be very happy with Jay Feaster.
Put Jay Feaster in that barn with Kevin Lowe and Brian Burke. Let him go.
Have a three-way fight?
Yeah, I mean, Brian Burke will beat both of them. Well, you've already fired Feaster, so
he just beat up Lowe. He already beat up Feaster in the Flames boardroom. Never mind what's going to happen in a barn fight. Anyways, let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Slava Malamud to talk about the Jets and
vodka,
Alex,
right?
Burmistrov.
Vodka?
No, not vodka. No, okay. Not Russian vodka today. He's the foreign correspondent for Sport Express out of Russia. So we'll talk about all things Russian hockey on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
One hour down, 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We're pleased to welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Slava Malamud. Slava is the foreign correspondent for Sport Express out of Russia. Slava, good morning, and thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning.
How are you?
All right, thank you. I'm in sunny Michigan right now with my son's Pee Wee hockey team on a tournament. So, perfect way to spend the weekend.
Yeah, sounds like fun chasing after a bunch of kids. You'll be ready for a holiday after that.
Well, they're ready for Silver Spike next week, so it's nonstop travel.
No kidding. Nonstop travel is right. Slava, obviously the Jets, they hired Paul Maurice last Sunday to be their new head coach, and he's replacing Claude Noel. And we heard, and they both denied it, but we heard that Claude Noel and Alex Burmistrov, had a rocky relationship during their time in Winnipeg. Do you think that with Paul Maurice's hiring and Claude Noel no longer being the head coach, do you expect that Alex Burmistrov will eventually return to the Winnipeg Jets?
Well, we'll see. Well, what else is new? A Canadian coach and a Russian high-scoring type of player having a rocky relationship? We've certainly never heard anything like that before, right? So, Burmistrov, I think last year, after the lockout and after he had a good time playing in Kazan in his hometown, he returned to the NHL, and it looked like he was wearing the Jets jersey, but mentally he was already in green and red, the Kazan colors. I mean, he was ready to come back, and I think he even if Noel would hug and kiss him every day, I don't think I don't think it would have changed his mind. And right now he's playing very well. I mean, if anything happens to anyone on of the wingers on the Russian Olympic team, he is the first call up to the Olympic team. So he's playing well. If whether the Jets can somehow lure him back, I'm not sure they wanna at this point, because he didn't really impress them. But if they do, it will all depend on the money, and it all depends on how much Kazan wants him, because and right now they do. At this point, I think they're willing to throw a lot more money at him than any NHL team is willing to. And if he somehow gets an Olympic roster, if there's an injury, and he plays well in the Olympics, that might change. But at this point, I think he's going the way of Nikita Filatov, being a career KHLer and playing well there for a lot more money than he would have been getting here.
Slava, you mentioned that you believe that there's a really good chance that Alex Burmistrov stays in the KHL, but if he decides that it's still something that he wants to do and come back to Winnipeg, and we've heard that there were some issues that he was asking for certain things contractually and that he had a bad relationship with Claude Noel, but as far as having a new coach, Paul Maurice is now the head coach of the Jets, as you know, how much of a factor would that have? Would Burmistrov say, okay, Paul Maurice is there, he's coached in Russia, maybe I'll come back to Winnipeg knowing that there's now a different coach there?
He would be willing to listen. And Paul Maurice obviously has a lot of street cred with Russian players now, and he knows how to treat them, and he knows the nuances of the Russian mentality, so to say. So yeah, Burmistrov would be willing to listen at this point, and if Maurice and the general manager are willing to talk. So there's that. I mean, obviously there's the contractual situation, which is the problem, because players of his kind do tend to get a lot more money, tend to get overpaid in the KHL. And I don't think the Jets are the kind of organization that's going to overpay players. So that, or can afford to overpay players. So I think there is that factor. It's probably going to be more important than player-coach relationship. But at least it opens the door. There's potentially an open door right now for Burmistrov to start talking. And if he wants to return to the NHL, that's not a factor. I mean, does he think that maybe the big ice is his kind of surface, and he has more fun playing in Russia? Well, then probably that's where he stays, because money will always be there for him in Russia.
Yeah, so why didn't he make the Russian Olympic team, based on the fact that, you know, he's had a really strong season in the KHL by all reports?
What happened is the Russian team, as you probably know, doesn't have anywhere close to the kind of depth that Canada has. Mm-hmm. So we have our top-end players who will make the team no matter what. Everybody knows those names. And then the coach felt that the players on the bottom two lines should be more defensive-minded players. I know that's what Noel was trying to make Burmistrov into, but it's not what Burmistrov is.
Right.
And, I mean, he's a great offensive player. But he wanted the coach wanted to maybe guys who are maybe a little bit low profile, but are more responsible in their own end, and he could build defensive minded lines out of them. So that was perhaps the reasoning. But the reason why Burmistrov is strongly considered is because he's playing in Kazan. The coach is from Kazan. And there's a lot of relationship. There's a relationship there. And the coach used to coach. Zinatulabila Lidinov used to be the head coach of Kazan. And, I mean, he's taken guys from that club, perhaps disproportionately. And I think that right now, I mean, he said it sort of like semi on the record. He said that Burmistrov is the first guy considered right now, if something goes wrong.
And Slava, is he playing center over in the KHL, or is he playing wing? And I think you alluded to the possibility that if he played on the team, it'd be more wing than center.
He'd be on the wing because the four centers are locked up.
Okay.
I mean, you look at Malkin, you look at Datsyuk, and Anisimov, the top three centers, and there is Tereshchenko, who is the defensive-minded type of center. Who is a lock for the national team. He's been on the national team forever, even though nobody in North America knows about him. But it depends on where the injury occurs. If a center is injured, then Burmistrov would be playing center.
Okay.
Because he has that experience. If a wing gets injured, then he'll be thrown on the wing.
You're listening
to that as well.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're joined by Slava Malamud, the foreign correspondent for Sport Express out of Russia. Slava, one more Winnipeg Jets player with Russian ties is Ivan Telegin. And we heard at the beginning, you know, sort of as training camp for the Winnipeg Jets ended, that he refused to report to St. John's, and he was suspended by the team. And then earlier this week, we heard that the Winnipeg Jets revoked the suspension as he's going he's going to report to a team in the KHL. Can you shed any more light onto that situation?
Well, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, the kid did not want to play in AHL. That's not his type of hockey, and that's not his type of salary. So the Jets most likely just decided it would be more advantageous for them to just make sure that situation goes away, and then the kid gets his playing experience wherever he gets it. I mean, obviously, they are going to be able to call him up now, but who knows? Maybe next year he returns in a better frame of mind. So, I mean, it's, you know, the inability to send Russians down to the AHL is well known. I mean, they come here with the expectation of either playing in the NHL. That's why they're here. They give up bigger salaries in Russia to realize their dream. That would have been a situation with Nichushkin in Dallas. Dallas would not be able to send him down to Texas because he went on the record saying, if they send me to the Texas Stars, I just go home. And that's what didn't happen in Dallas because they gave him the time to develop, and that's what happened with Telegin. Telegin is getting all kinds of money in Russia at this point. It just makes no sense for him to ride the bus down in the Atlantic provinces.
Slavo, Richie asked you about Alex Burmistrov. Just going back to the Olympics, as far as Alexander Semin goes, I'm sure you've asked this, answered this question a lot in the last couple of weeks, but another Alex Semin on the Carolina Hurricanes, it was a bit of a surprise that he didn't make the team. He hasn't been putting up the offensive numbers that he's put up in the past. In your opinion, why was he left off of Team Russia?
Well, it's straightforward. I mean, they've never been, the coaching staff right now, they've never been big fans of Semin. I've talked to Igor Kravchuk, who is the assistant coach in charge of NHL scouting, and he said that, you know, he's just not the kind of player that we like. I mean, if you don't backcheck in Russia, your name better be Ovechkin or Datsyuk or Ovechkin or Kovalchuk or Malkin. You know, if you don't backcheck and your name isn't one of those three, then you probably aren't going to make this particular team. And the coach said on a press conference just a couple of days ago that, I mean, his offensive numbers haven't been impressive either, so they just ran out of reasons to give him another chance.
So in terms of pressure on Russia, I mean, you know, in Canada, obviously, 2010, there was an immense amount of pressure on the Canadian team because they're playing at home, although there's that pressure all the time, which I realize there is in Russia as well. How would you, you know, equate the pressure in Russia this time around to that of Canada in 2010?
Probably more, a lot more. You see, I mean, we haven't won for a long time. I mean, last time we won was 1992, and it was a different country, and it was a different team. And as Russia, as a matter of fact, I mean, we went through 15 years not even winning world championships. We haven't won an Olympic medal of any kind since Salt Lake City. So it's getting very frustrating, and it's at home. And when you look at the high-end stars that we produce in the NHL, Hart Trophy winners, Vezina Trophy winner, Selke winners, you know, it's people don't really understand why that success doesn't translate to the national team performance. And besides, you know, while Canadians are crazy about their hockey, in Canada, if you lose, you know, you can go on with your life. In Russia, if you're a KHL player and if you play badly, you know, things may happen to your career that you're going to regret at some point. there's a lot of political pressure. There's a lot of the cultural pressure because Russians don't really take defeats very lightly, especially in hockey, where we're an intense nation, as you might know. And I think it's a lot greater than what was on Canadians in Vancouver, just simply because of the accumulation of these factors. I mean, Russia is just not as free and easygoing a nation as you guys are.
Slava, how much of the Russian Olympic team, the selection process, how much of that is political in your mind?
I think with this particular coach, it's not as much as it was in Vancouver. Because in Vancouver, there was definitely a movement to draft as many KHL players into the national team as possible, just to show the world that the KHL is an important league. And I think this coach, he has coached in the NHL before. He likes North American type of hockey, And he decided for himself that at this point, there's nothing to lose. If he wins, nobody is going to tell him that he didn't take enough KHL players, obviously. He can just, you know, spit on the rest of the world. He's the winner. He's the hero forever. If he loses, then it doesn't matter how many KHL players he took. Because last time when we lost in Vancouver, those KHL players were to blame in the media and with the fans for their inability to run with the Canadiens in the quarterfinal. So he said, you know, there's no pressure on him in that regard. I mean, it's all about winning at this point.
Slava, I'm not sure if you saw the reorientation series on TSN, but we were talking about that in the first hour of the show this morning. And, you know, the Olympics are coming up in Russia, and there have been some concerns about homophobia in Russia. Yep. Do you think that the involvement of the NHL in the Olympics will raise some awareness in Russia on this issue?
I don't think the NHL really wants to touch this thing, the Russian political thing with the 10-foot pole. I mean, I know the NHL is very proactive and progressive on this issue, perhaps a lot more than the other leagues. And I know the NHL is rightfully proud of it. But to get into a political spit battle with Russia and to start making gestures, I don't think that's something that Bill Daly and Gary Bettman really want. I think it's going to be left to the individual players to say whatever they want to say. I think most players, knowing that, you know, hockey players are usually low-key guys, and they probably will abstain from it. As for the Russians themselves, I mean, the go-to tactic right now seems to be, you know, I'm a hockey player, I'm dumb, I don't know anything about hockey. Because when Kovalchuk said a few things in support of the Russian law, and Datsyuk alluded to himself being a religious person, you know, dropping a heavy hand there. I don't think it's going to go beyond that. It's one thing that people in North America don't really understand is that this law, unfortunately, has a very wide support in Russia, very wide popular support. And the more gestures the Americans make, the more hardened that support becomes. It's just the spirit of contrariety that the Russian people possess. And whatever topples this situation, whatever changes it, I don't think that Olympic gestures will. I may be wrong. You know, the Black Power salute in 1968 may have changed a few things for the better. But I don't think Russia is that kind of country where public protests from foreigners never really change things for the better. It has to come from within.
Slava Malamud is the foreign correspondent for Sport Express out of Russia. Slava, thanks very much for joining us this morning. Great interview.
No problem at all. Always set.
Take care. Thanks very much, Slava.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Big thank you to Slava Malamud for just joining us to talk about all things Russian hockey. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on iTunes, on TSN1290.ca, and it'll be available on our website, IllegalCurve.com, not too long after this fine program ends. McPhillips Toyota Winnipeg Jets game day, the Jets and the Oilers, 1 p.m. puck drop at MTS Center this afternoon. You can hear that game live on TSN 1290. Gentlemen, well, first of all, before we get into the Dustin Byfuglien conversation, I want to make note, we're going to open up the phone lines.
Yes.
It's something we rarely do, but we're going to open up the phone line starting at 9:30 this morning. Whatever's on your mind, be it Dustin Byfuglien, be it trade rumors, be it the Winnipeg Jets performance, 9:30 this morning.
What are you talking about?
Why? You want it to be very specific?
Yeah, I want to know. What
can I call in?
Yeah, well, I think you're calling in right now.
He's phoning it in.
I want to know whether people think that Dustin Byfuglien should stay at forward or not. That's what I want to know.
Okay, then that's what it's going to be. 9:30 this morning, should Dustin Byfuglien stay as a forward or move back to the defense of the Winnipeg Jets? Let's talk about Dustin Byfuglien as a forward and the salary cap impact it has on the Winnipeg Jets. Byfuglien under contract 2 more years after this season, making $5.2 million per season. if he was a regular forward, if you, you know, sort of permanently slotted him in as a forward, except on the power play, he would be the third highest paid forward on the team. Wheeler making 5.6, Kane making $5.25 million. Wheeler, you would presume, is the top forward, the number one right winger on this team. Can the Jets afford to pay Dustin Byfuglien $5.2 million as a second-line right winger, given their salary cap structure?
Yeah, I think they can. And I think it works in the way, you know, I did a salary cap article on IllegalCurve.com talking about this situation. Now, what happens is if you move that $5.2 million from the back end where you have the redundancy of right side defensemen, and you have to play one of those guys, Byfuglien, Bogosian, or Trouba, if you want to get them all ice time on the wrong side, what it does is it moves a player, and you had a need, and instead of Gucci's not a top six forward on a good team, if you can make Byfuglien a top six right winger behind Wheeler and have your top six wingers be Ladd and Kane, then you really, what you need to do is then fix the left side of your defense in top four, and I'm talking top four, and then you have to get a center. And Scheifele's played well in a little, but if you need another center in there, and not Ulli Jokinen, who Grant has played well now, but if you get a center, which is not easy to get, and a top four left side defenseman, to me it works that way. It makes so much more sense than the other way to do it. So I think Drew actually ends up helping them, not only on the ice, which I think it has helped, I think salary cap wise, both now and in the future.
Right, because you're taking that salary, Richie, away from the defense where you're already playing Bogo a lot of money, you're already playing Enstrom a lot of money,
yes,
and you're going to be paying Trouba a lot of money a couple of years from now when he signs his next contract, regardless if it's a bridge contract or a long-term deal. And I have to think that each side is going to want to have their own particular deal. We've seen a guy like PK Subban sign a bridge contract, and it actually was more beneficial to him. So Dustin Byfuglien right now has played three straight games at forward, and about a week and a half ago, before his first game, I guess it was around there, about a week maybe, 3 games ago, let's say that, when the decision was made by Claude Noel to first off have Dustin Byfuglien practice as a forward for the purpose of playing him as a forward, I think he's done a really good job. First game, I believe he played about 17 minutes, and the second game he played 20 minutes. And the second game he played 20 minutes because he was having so many chances on the power play. If you remember, against the Phoenix Coyotes, I think there were 7 or 8 power plays in that game. So I think Dustin Byfuglien, first and foremost, should stay a forward for at least the near future, whether it's 2 weeks or the rest of the season, because there's only about 2.5 months left in the season. So I think, especially if the plan going forward is to keep him as a forward, then you got to play him for the rest of the season, because you can't just take a small sample size, and even 5 or 10 games is kind of a small sample size. Let him get used to playing forward, because that's going to be where he plays, you know, probably on this team. But back to what Richie said about the salary cap implications, they can't do anything about the salary that he was given by Don Waddell, right? So he makes $5.2 million for the next couple of years. So that's what he's going to make. Now, is it maybe a little bit much for a guy that's probably going to play third line? Yeah, probably, but you could say that David Clarkson isn't really right in the top six of the Toronto Maple Leafs either, and he's making quite a bit of money. The whole economics in the NHL don't really make sense. You have a lot of players making more than they quote-unquote should be making. So I think that Dustin Byfuglien, it's not a big problem. I think he slots in as a right winger on the third line really nicely. If he needs to come up and play second line forward, he can. He's one of the...
I think he's a second line right winger. Don't you?
I don't think he has the speed to be a second line right winger, but I think that he has the ability to play second line. I think that if you look at the Jets, ideally, you're going to have Blake Wheeler, right, slotting in as your first line right winger, or they've been playing Michael Frolik. So I think it's interesting.
But I mean, like, talent-wise. Do you think he's better than Frolik? I think he's better than Frolik.
It's not apples and apples, but I think that he's definitely not a first-line right winger. So the question is he a second-line right winger or a third-line right winger? I don't think his skating ability or his two-way ability as a forward is good enough to be a second-line right winger. I think ideally he plays a third-line right winger role and plays first-line power play.
I think you can compensate for his weaknesses a lot better as a forward than you can as a defenseman.
Yeah. And I realize that, you know, bringing the puck out of the zone, all those strings are something that you're going to miss. But they have players who can skate and move the puck. I mean, that's not an issue. That's why I like this move. Another thing is, if you're paying him 5.2, he doesn't even need to be. I mean, I think he's a second-line right winger, but even if he is a third-line right winger, as he says, and that very well could be the case,
There's no right or wrong answer, by the way.
But not just that,
they're using him right now as a third line right winger doesn't mean he's going
to
stay.
Well, I mean, yeah, because they have three. To me, he's a second line right winger. But even if he is a third line, as this is the point, it's that you're not only paying him for that purpose, you're also getting a top power play quarterback out of it.
Right.
So that you're getting value out of that. If you apportion that money, I mean, come on, the flexibility is great. And to me, this is the case. This is the issue here. You have to stop having the inmates run the asylum. It's enough. He doesn't want to play. Who cares?
He's played very well the last three games in that position.
He has, but at some point, you can't. You know, you're not a winning team.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't decide where he's playing. You decide. The coach decides. And we're gonna. And people are gonna have been critical of Claude Noel. But keep in mind, it was Claude Noel who moved him up before he got fired. So just people remember that.
And he also played forward at points both years, actually. But mainly last year. But more to your point, Richie, about the versatility. I think people aren't talking about this. Some of his in-game versatility. If the Jets lose a defenseman, you're in-game.
Good point, yeah.
Dustin Byfuglien can move back to defense. I mean, I've said this many times on this show this year. I don't believe that the Jets should trade Dustin Byfuglien. As far as will they trade Dustin Byfuglien, I mean, flip a coin. A lot of people think that mm-hmm. Dustin Byfuglien is on the trade market, or a lot of teams covet him. As far as I'm concerned, Dustin Byfuglien is second on the team in scoring. He's a very versatile player. He's better as a forward. I think you keep him, and I think he is going to get better. His attitude is going to change as a forward. I think, again, and Richie was one of the first people, if not the first person, to mention this. One of Dustin Byfuglien's big problems this year and last year is that he was playing too many minutes. Dustin Byfuglien is not the type of guy that can play the Shea Weber, Zdeno Chara, Ryan Suter minutes. And the Jets were asking him to play Shea Weber, Zdeno Chara, Ryan Suter minutes. So you're talking 26, 30 minutes a game. He's not built for that. Dustin Byfuglien is, whether it's second line, and I see Richie's point, he's definitely talented enough to play even first line. But if he plays 15 to 20 minutes because you give him some extra time on the power play, that's fine. But he is a type of guy that I think can be part of the future of this team. He's under contract for two more years. You know, after that, we'll see where it goes.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about Dustin Byfuglien. We're going to talk about the trade value, to look at it from that angle, if the Jets went down that road. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca.
You've been listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and tsn1290.ca.